Cecilia, for the invitation, which makes it possible for me to give a talk here. Already, well, some years ago, when I was studying mathematics and physics at the University of Utrecht, I followed some courses in foundations of physics, and these were taught by Jos Uffink, and Jos Uffink emphasized several times that at some point it should definitely go to the Perimeter Institute. And well, now I have the opportunity to give a talk here in the foundations group, so that's pretty neat. What I will be talking about is, you know, basically the work I've been doing as a grad student at the University of Nijmegen in the mathematical physics group. And it concerns ideas by Chris Isham and collaborators, and also ideas which were inspired by the work of Isham regarding the use of topos theoretic methods in the hope that it sheds some new light on foundations of quantum theory. So here I have an outline of the talk in the form of four papers and a preprint. Well, actually a draft rather than a preprint. So in order to explain a bit about my own research and to actually get the message across which I want to, well, what I want to talk about, I need to go back to the work of Butterfield and Isham, and also by Andreas Döring and Isham, and also cover an alternative topos model by Klaas Landsman and others before I can finally state what my own ideas are. And yeah, it's enough to do. Please note, I am a mathematician, so it's very likely that I give pretty much horrible talks and make huge errors and assumptions regarding what you do and do not know. So if stuff gets unclear, please ask questions. I'm not here to waste your time, so if stuff gets unclear, do not hesitate to ask questions. Okay, so yeah, let's get started with the work of Butterfield and Isham. I only want to cover some of the ideas which were treated in a series of four papers called A Topos Perspective on the Cauchy-Speckle Theorem. Only some aspects which I need later on. And yeah, basically motivated by physical principles, Butterfield and Isham come to the conclusion that the mathematical branch of topos theory may have something to contribute to foundations of quantum theory. So let's look at some of the ideas sketched there. I will start with a more or less standard formulation of quantum theory. So suppose we have some system which we want to describe with a quantum theory, then associated to the system, we can have a von Neumann algebra A. Now, I don't assume that everyone here knows what a von Neumann algebra is. So if you're not comfortable with that, just read here the bounded linear operators on some Hilbert space associated to the system. And if you don't like bounded linear operators on the Hilbert space, just think of the n by n complex matrices. That is then my operator algebra. So these operators, these encode the observables of your theory, in particular self-adjoint elements of this operator algebra represent observables or emission matrices, if we are thinking in terms of these matrices. And yeah, what more do I need? States. I also need states. And for me, a state will be a positive linear a positive, normalized, linear, functional on the operator algebra. If you don't like that, just think of a density matrix or a density operator. And let psi be given by mapping operator A to taking the trace of road MZ. So this is, these are the basic ingredients. And from that, I construct a topos. And at the moment, I'm not going to, well, describe what actually a topos is. I will treat that just a little later. But at this point, I need to construct at least one example of a topos. The first step is in considering the partially ordered set of contexts. A context here will be defined as context C will be defined as a abelian von Neumann subalgebra of A. So abelian subalgebra. Or matrix subalgebras, if you're thinking in terms of that. And yeah, because the elements commute, I can think of this, and I prefer to think of such a set as a measurement context. And this is something which is usually not done, at least in the work of Isham and collaborators. I don't think they see this as a measurement context. They want to think in terms of, they would seek a realist interpretation for their theory, a realist formalism, actually. That's the new realist thing. But for me, I consider, as I will explain a little later, when I think of a topos model, I consider an internal perspective and an external perspective. I reserve realist thinking to the internal perspective. When I move external, then I'm fine with considering these all the stuff which I see as, I'm fine with thinking of that in operationalist terms. And I think that in itself is already an interesting thing to do, because, well, I'm just a mathematician, but to me it seems like in the progress of physics, both realist kind of thinking and instrumentalist kind of thinking have an important role to play. So yeah, I think if we have a healthy way of looking at these theories, we should have both perspectives. Yeah, go ahead.
So is it a context is like a set of commuting observables?
Yes, right. Yes, and closed on the algebraic operations. I want to make it into an algebra, but these are commuting elements. These context, there's another way to think of this as being something which is more classical, and that is by means of the Gelfand duality. My Gelfand duality, according to Gelfand duality, such an abelian subalgebra, to such an abelian subalgebra, we can associate a topological space, a compact Hausdorff space, in such a way that up to isomorphism, this algebra is the algebra of continuous complex valued functions on this topological space. So that gives it some classical vibe, but usually I just think of it as a collection of commuting operators as a measurement context. But this is also a nice way, and I will need these Gelfand spectra, these associated compact Hausdorff space, quite often. We take the set of all contexts, denoted here by curly C. So this is a set of all contexts, and I see it as a partially ordered set where the contexts are ordered by inclusion. Now the topos which is used in these topos approaches. Well, in the topos approaches approach by Chris Eichmann collaborators, is the topos of pre-sheaves on this set of context. I will denote it like this. So at the moment, I do not yet want to explain what a topos is. In fact, I can't explain what a topos is. That would be more the material of a complete course rather than a 1 hour talk. But at some point, I want to give an idea of what a topos is, or at least how I consider topoi in these approaches. But yeah, this category of pre-sheaves, this collection of pre-sheaves and functors between them, and I will give a description of what a pre-sheave is in a few minutes. This plays an important this arises in a quite natural way in the work of Butterfield and Isham. So let's get this out of the way. What is a pre-sheave? And I will simultaneously, I will give an example of a pre-sheave, which is actually the only pre-sheave which I will explicitly consider in this talk, and which is the spectral pre-sheave, and which is one of the most important objects in this approach. So how do I define a pre-sheave? What is a pre-sheave on C? First of all, for every context, I should have a set sigma C, and in the example of the spectral pre-sheaf, I will define it to be the Gelfand spectrum, the compact Hausdorff space, such that C can be seen as the continuous functions, complex valued functions on this space. But such a family of sets alone does not define a pre-sheaf. Apart from having all these sets, there should also be relations. Suppose that D and C are two contexts which are related by inclusion. Then I should also must also define a function between these two associated sets. And this function again is defined by Gelfand duality. As D is a subset of C, I can consider the inclusion map of D and C, and Gelfand duality says that such a morphism of algebras corresponds to a continuous map on the corresponding spectra. So I take these for my functions here. Now there's one final condition before, yeah? These?
Yeah.
The Gelfand spectra. Compact Hausdorff, unique compact Hausdorff space associated to any operator algebra, such as a Sita algebra or a Neumann algebra, which is commutative, such that C is isomorphic to continuous functions on this space. So if I take a single operator, take the algebra generated by that, then up to isomorphism, this guy is just the spectrum of an operator. So in the matrix case, if I start out with a single operator, generate an algebra from it, I just get the eigenvalues.
So these are sort of sets of values which these observables can simultaneously take.
Yeah. There is one more condition in order to call it a pre-sheaf, but yeah, that's not very interesting for what follows, so I'll just leave it at this. appreciative over the set of contexts means having for every context a set, and these should be related by functions whenever we have such a relation between the sets. Now, what is one reason why this topos is interesting is because the spectral presheaf has a nice property. Suppose we start out with bounded operators on a Hilbert space, and the dimension of the Hilbert space is at least 3, then this spectral presheaf, this single object, this object in this topos has no global sections or global points or global elements, and this is just a mathematically equivalent statement of the Cauchy-Specker theorem. The Cauchy-Specker theorem states that this guy has no global sections in this case that A is B of H and the dimension of H is at least 3. So yeah, there is no consistent way to, for each and every context, pick out a value in a consistent way with these functions. That's prohibited by the Cauchy-Specker theorem. So that's one reason why they consider this topos, but not the best reason. I think another more important reason has to do with assignment of truth values to propositions in a contextual way. So that's the second and last point about the work of Butterfield and Isham that I want to mention. So suppose we start out with some state psi, we consider an observable A, and we have delta, which is some Borel measurable subset of the real numbers, or some nice subset of the spectrum of A. And we consider the proposition relative to state psi, A takes values in delta. Well, normally, when I think of this, normally in quantum theory, I would say, given A and this subset, I can associate a spectral projection to it. And I consider this statement to be true in the sense that I know with certainty upon performing a measurement of the observable corresponding A that I will get a value which lies in delta when psi maps this projection to 1. That's kind of the normal, well, operationalist way of doing this. Now with Butterfield and Isham, and I will slightly abuse the way that they work because I'm thinking more operationalist here. They say, they want to, suppose we want to associate a truth value from an arbitrary measurement context. I mean, yeah, we can verify this from a context, see, as long as A is in there. If A is in there, we can measure A and we can affirm whether this is the case or not. Suppose we take another context such that A is not in there. We can't verify this experimentally. So what we can consider is, suppose we take all projections in C, so all simple yes-no experiments which are accessible from this context C, which are weaker than the original claim, weaker in some imprecise sense, And because I'm working with phenomenon algebras in a mathematically precise way, you can say, well, I take the smallest projection, which is in my context, which does correspond to a measurement. And this guy is still above, is still greater than the original projection, which I want to consider. And I say that this claim is true relative to the context C if psi maps this projection to one. So I generally tend to think of this as far as we can see from the context C, as far as we can determine from the context C, this proposition holds. A truth value, a complete truth value to this proposition using this kind of contextuality means taking the set of contexts such that this condition holds. So I'm considering, if this proposition is true in the normal instrumentalistic sense, then for each context C, this condition will hold, and I will get all of these contexts back. The only real point that I want to make here is that in this way, in a contextual way, we associate to propositions of this kind truth values, which take the form of subsets of this poset of context. Well, actually, it has a stronger physical motivation in the work of Butterfield and Isham, but they arrive at these truth values, and these truth values are exactly the kind of truth values that you get when you play with topos theory, with this specific topos where also the spectral pre-sheaf lives. So yeah, I just wanted to mention this because one, it's important that to realize for later that these pre-sheafs that working in a topos we get, apart from a statement, a proposition being either true or false, we can have intermediate truth values. And in the case of these topos models, which I consider, these truth values are contextual. And I also thought this was, this is one of the central points here. And that's just about everything I have time for to say about the work of Butterfield and Isham. And now I move to to the masterpiece, What is a Thing by, yeah? Sets of contexts. Each context such that take the smallest projection which is available there, which is above this guy, and it gets mapped to one.
So how does that relate? Is each proposition like a pre-sheaf?
You get. In a while, I'll arrive at a topos internal formulation of this model, and what I get is propositions inside this topos. And when I spell them out, so a proposition always has a truth value. When I spell them out, I just get these lists of contexts back. These are the propositions which arise in these topos models when we reformulate the quantum theory, at least at mathematical level, internal to this topos. When we reformulate everything in this topos, then at the end we will get such truth values out of there. Yeah?
A certain amount of this complication seems to come from thinking of possibly infinite dimensional objects. When you talk about Borel sets and all that.
Mm-hmm. I think finite dimensional Hilbert spaces are a very interesting setting. to do this. I mostly concentrated myself on infinite dimensional cases, but if I just think of the, for example, the work by Samson Abramsky and Adam Brandenburger on pre-sheaves and this, it seems to fit very nicely with this formalism. There, all kinds of interesting stuff is going on at the for the finite dimensional cases. So I think that the finite dimensional case is interesting, at the least.
I just suspect some of those things could be said more simply if you look at it
yourself. Yeah. Yeah.
You wouldn't have to talk about the Neumann algebras and Gell-Kant duality and all this.
Yeah, that's, yeah, definitely. And it would just be about matrices, eigenvalues, and yeah, it would be simpler, but I... Yeah, good point. And I will now move to point two, and the scheme of neorealism set out by Chris Isham and Andreas Döring there in the paper, What is a Thing? The basic idea is that, any theory of physics in its mathematical formulation should share some structural properties with, which make it look to some extent like a classical theory. And these properties are needed to give some, well, minimal realist account of the theory. So it's, on the one hand, it's a restriction on the shape in this mathematical formulation that a theory of physics can have. On the other hand, they add some freedom by saying, well, we can interpret this structure in any topos. We can use sets and functions as we used to, but we can also use the language of pre-sheaves or, in fact, any topos we would like. This is, of course, very vague. And let's first see what these structures are, which they demand. First of all, suppose we have some system which we want to describe, and I think of quantum systems here. Suppose we have some system, then we start out with some topos. And we formulate everything in terms of what is available in this topos. Can be sets, can be pre-sheaves, can be something else. There are many different kinds of topoi, even though they are very special kind of categories. So we start out with a topos. Inside this topos associated to our system, we should have some object which we can think of, which we think of as acting as a state space. Well, from the notation here, it's clear what they have in mind with their own model. So that would be pre-sheaves on the post-set of context here, and the spectral pre-sheaf in some way should act as a state space. Apart from that, there's another space which needs to be identified, a space of values, and our physical quantities which we want to consider should be represented by arrows in this topos from the state space to the space of values. And we think of, we want to, in this formalism, we think of A actually having values, taking values in this object. There's some more to, if we also want to consider propositions, for example, of the kind, so we have some physical quantity, we have some set of values, we want to represent elements, propositions like this, by sub-objects of this state space object. And one reason why these people working in there find this state, these such a, well, these sub-objects interesting is in that they form a Heiting algebra, a distributive lattice more general than a Boolean algebra. And well, the idea is to formulate a quantum logic with this Heiting algebra, which acts as an alternative to the non-distributive lattice of projections in Birkhoff von Neumann quantum logic. Well, I will barely talk about this because what I want to do is already complicated enough. Yeah, so I have my state space, value space. So when I first encountered this, I wasn't, well, that enthusiastic about this idea. There are several problems. First of all, there seems to be no ideas on what would make a good topos. Suppose we have some theory. I know for quantum theory what they propose, but yeah, what's the role? How do we construct a good topos? How would you find a good topos? There seems to be no ideas involved in neorealism in that. Another problem is that, yeah, the idea is that it should have some resemblance to classical theory. Well, to classical physics, I don't think that having an abstract category, having objects and arrows, looks all that classical. I'm missing some, I don't see how this is in itself more classical. Another thing related to the previous point is there are no non-trivial models other than this pre-sheaf model, which they introduced, and where this is the spectral pre-sheaf. This is, well, it's some pre-sheaf constructed by over the real numbers. And these operators are, of these arrows are constructed using a technique called Dasynization. I doubt that I will have time to talk about that. So yeah, seems like this, if this is a good idea, it would definitely need a lot of work before you can make anything of it. And to come back to an earlier point, the formalism is thought of as geared to, is intended to fit a realist account of the theory. If I look at this, this topos, or in fact any topos, I have two ways of thinking of topos, internal and external. I would like to be able to think about the quantum theory, at least, from either an operationalist and from a realist perspective, and to be able to play with both of these perspectives. So that's also something that I would like. Now I'm able to move to the third part by Heuner, Lanzmann, and by the work of Heuner, Lanzmann, and Spitters. And they introduce an alternative model, an alternative topos model. And here the internal language of topoi plays a role. So I can finally get to explain that a bit. So in the work of Heuner, Lanzmann, and Spitters, they say, well, suppose we replace our pre-sheaf topos by another guy, the topos of co-pre-sheaves. So what is a co-pre-sheaf? Basically, it's like a pre-sheaf we have for every context an associated set. The only difference is that now the functions point in the other direction. The reason why they consider this is that they can define the following object, which is kind of like a dual to the spectral pre-sheaf. To each context C, we just associate the set C itself. And of course, if D is a smaller context, then we get an inclusion map as a function here. So taking all these contexts and the inclusions defines a single object or a single co-precieve in this category, in this topos. Why do they find this interesting? That they find this interesting because in the internal language of the topos, this is a commutative C star algebra or commutative operator algebra. What do I mean by the internal language of a topos? A topos is a very special kind of category. It's a category which has a massive amount of structure, and this structure makes it able to think of this category as something which is very close to the category of sets, in the sense that we can interpret all kinds of complicated mathematical stuff inside this topos. We can talk about groups, C-star algebras, about rings, about topological spaces in a topos. And we can also do mathematics with these notions in very much the same way, and that's important, very much the same way as we would do in sets. However, there are some differences. So what's the idea? Well, I think if X is some object in some topos, so it can be a co-precieve, it can be a precieve, it can be a set, it can be a set with a group action, it can be a finite set, it can be a sheaf, I don't care what topos, if X is a object in the topos, I will think of it, when I consider the internal perspective, I will think of it as a set. And if I have an arrow in this topos, I tend to think of that as a function. Of course, we can state that in any category. What sets a topos apart from other categories is that in a topos, it is a good idea to consider this perspective. For one thing, a topos has power objects, which means that we have a notion of power set. It has exponentials, so we can have sets of functions. We have all kinds of structure which we usually take for granted in the category of sets, all available in a topos. One important difference is what I consider an element of a set. Suppose for a moment that I have a set in the usual sense. So I'm working not in an arbitrary topos, I'm working in the specific topos, where the objects are sets and the arrows are functions. Then an element X in X can be seen as equivalent as to a function from the singleton to the set. That's just an equivalent way of writing this. So category theorists will write one here for the and call it the terminal object, but I think of it as a singleton right now. For working with sets, considering elements of a set in this way, that's a good idea. For an arbitrary topos, this is a bad idea. For one thing, the spectral precief that we have here, well, by the Cauchy Speckle theorem, that simply states that this guy has no, and that in many interesting cases, this guy has no global points, has no elements. So what is a fruitful notion of an element of a set in an arbitrary topos? Well, we generalize. We take just an arbitrary object here, and any arrow from any object into X is thought of as an element here. So we need generalized elements when working internally, in the internal perspective of topos. So this is one, yeah?
That going back there, what you said, there is no terminal object.
Well, there is a terminal object. There is no arrow from the terminal object to the spectral precieve. That's an equivalent statement of the Cauchy Speckle theorem. So in a topos, we can interpret all these kinds of structures. We can talk, for example, about what is a topological space in a topos. Well, what is a topological space when we define it as sets? Well, we take some set X, we want to topologize it. Then we take a subset of the power set such that the empty set is an element of it, and the space self is an element of it, and the other conditions for a topology. We can write this down and interpret this in any topos. For example, you can take a standard book on topos theory, for example, Sheaves in Geometry of Logic by MacLean and Moerdijk, and it will explain how this is all translated in a topos categorically. But that's not the point. The point is that we don't need to do abstract category theory when working with a topos. We can, as long as we restrict to generalized elements, do mathematics in a topos in the same way as we would do in set theory. So this would take a lot of time to explain in a convincing way. I'm not even going to attempt that here. But I think it's a very cool feature. But as I said, there are important differences between doing set theory internal of a topos and doing normal set theory. For one thing, we have these generalized elements. Another, for propositions, we can assign to them truth values, and they may be, well, depending on the topos, there may be a lot of different truth values between a statement being true and false. You can have a multi-valued, you can have many different truth values. Yet another difference is that although each and every statement of intuitionistic predicate calculus holds in this, in any topos, for most topoi, the axiom of choice is not validated, and the law of excluded middle does not work, which means that if we choose to assume them, like we could in sets, this will lead to contradictions. Now, on the one hand, I consider this an interesting point. On the other hand, it makes mathematics internal to a topos harder. So yeah, I hope that I just made a little bit clear what I mean by thinking in the internal language of a topos, and this works in any topos. And in the model of Heune, Lanzmann, and Spitters, this plays an important role, as well as in my own work. So, yeah, I think it's time to remove these blackboards and go to the model. Yeah.
Your definition of element, even in the case of sets, it would be a different notion of element. So can we use that notion of element just when we're dealing with ordinary sets?
We can use that. The point is that you don't. Yeah, but what's typical of sets is that you don't need to consider. I mean, in sets, for sets, not. For sets, I see no reason, at least from topos theory, to consider these generalized. There's some class of topoi among which sets is, for which we can just consider only elements of this kind and just reason with that. Adding any set in the normal sense is completely determined by its elements in this usable sense. So we can add more generalized elements, but you would gain nothing. That's the difference between sets and many other topoi. Here you can, for normal sets, you can choose to consider generalized elements, but you would gain nothing because any set is already determined by its, well, points, by its global.
Is that the main point, that any set is determined by all generalized elements?
In an arbitrary topos, you would need generalized elements. Actually, for sets, you just need to consider y equal to the singleton. Then you know the set. Yeah, the set is completely determined by its generalized elements. And in the case of normal sets, it suffices to consider singletons for Y. In the case of a pre-sheaf or co-pre-sheaf topos, there is also a smaller class of Y, which it suffices to consider these guys. But in an arbitrary topos, yeah, it may take many different Y just to describe your set X completely.
So in the topos set, your elements are every function from every other set.
All generalized elements are any generalized element is any function mapping into X. But again, when people consider the topos of sets itself, there is nothing to gain by considering all these functions at the same time. And typically, people working in topos theory, when they look at a certain topos, they look around what is some minimal class of different sets or objects Y which we need to consider, because it's of course ridiculous to work with each and every object. In particular, the identity is included there. Normally, in practice, you just consider some class of generalized elements, or not even generalized elements, if your topos is sufficiently close to sets. And these would suffice to tell you everything about the set. The point here is that for pre-sheaves, just taking global points, that won't do, as already seen by the spectral pre-sheaf. Well, it maps from a partially ordered set to a collection of the sets itself. It's usually called by Lanzmann a tautological functor, but yeah, it's pretty close to the identity. Definitely. So it's just looking at your operators or your matrices from a context instead of, looking at them context independent. But we started out with an operator algebra. This defines almost the identity, an object in this topos, in the internal language of the topos, that this is a commutative C-star algebra. So we can use Gelfand duality and associate to it a spectrum. Now, as I said before, in an arbitrary topos, we don't have access to the axiom of choice. So analysis works slightly different. The notion, for example, of a topological space is less useful because, for example, the Gelfand duality, it uses the axiom of choice at various stages. In such a setting, it's rewarding to replace the notion of a topological space by that of a locale. I'm not going to give a definition of a locale, but a locale is any Hausdorff space gives a locale, and from that locale we can get the Hausdorff space back. So we'll just think of it as a generalization of a topological space. But I need it here because I'm working in a category which does not validate the axiom of choice. So sometimes I need some tricks.
Would we need the axiom of choice if we were limiting the finite dimensional open space?
I'm not sure. I I have no idea if I have to think about that. I can't give you a clear answer right away. So associated to my operator algebra, there is a compact, completely regular locale. And if I had access to the axiom of choice, then a compact, completely regular locale would be the same as a compact Hausdorff space. And they say, well, we can think of this guy as a state space.
So that is a co-preci.
Yeah.
We're in the top of the co-preci.
Yes, yes.
And that A up there is the one that Lanzmann.
Yeah.
And then you define a new one, sigma.
Yeah, it's by constructing the Galfond spectrum internally. In the internal language of the topoi, because there is, I can do Galfond duality in a topos. It's really, it is a universe where we can do mathematics just like in a quite powerful way. Only with some subtleties, some things become more subtle because, well, no axiom of choice, no law of excluded middle. That, yeah, I'm working here over sets, so this is completely external. So the internal language of the topos of pre-sheaves does not play a role here. But I'll come back to that because we can, given this pre-sheave model, we can work internally. We can describe this work of Isham in terms of the internal language of this pre-sheaf topos. So I briefly need to discuss this. So we have this internal locale, this internal space. There is another internal locale, the interval, called the interval domain, which is important in this model. So I'll consider the interval domain in sets. If I was working in the topos of sets, I would say the interval domain consists of, is the set of closed intervals of real numbers. Take all these guys and x and y can be equal, all these closed intervals, this set, together with a topology on it, by saying, well, a basic open XY consists of all closed intervals. All closed intervals such that these are contained in X and Y. So the set of these elements, these approximations of real numbers as Brouwer used to use them, together with the topology generated by this, by these subsets with varying x or y, that is called the interval domain in sets. And in fact, in any topos, we can perform a similar construction. In any Grothendieck topos, we have a lot of structure. We have natural numbers from which we can construct integers, rationals, various kinds of real numbers. Real numbers are subtle in a topos, because we are working constructively, you have different kinds of real numbers, which, in case you're working with sets, are defined the same object. So there's this space of values, and any operator, any self-adjoint operator or Hermitian matrix defines a continuous function from this space to this guy. Any subset of the real numbers, any Borel subset of the real numbers, defines a sub-object here, and we can construct the inverse image. Let's take an open subset of real numbers, then this gives an open subset here. And we can look at the inverse image of a continuous function. and in this way represent elementary propositions about the physical system as opens of a state space. The final ingredient is that any state can be represented by a probability measure on this state space. So in the internal language, this is a probability measure on the state space. And it maps to the, well, real numbers from 0 to 1. And the subscript L is needed because, again, real numbers are subtle in Topos theory. So as I'm running out of time, I'll just state the actual point because I, well, only did the first three. I thought this was a quite a cool topos model, but it has one problem. I think it's interesting because it's we have the more traditional external descriptions where we start out with, and internally it looks more like classical physics. However, what is not clear from this description, because it uses the internal language quite heavily, is that what we get at the end makes sense physically. For example, suppose that we consider this claim relative to a state psi, A takes values in delta. Now, in this more or less classically looking formalism, I can represent my delta here, my physical quantity as a continuous map here, and my state as a probability measure. So I can formulate this sentence is equal to the number 1. So this gives a proposition in my topos. What was not clear at first is what we get here when we write down that out externally, what it means in terms of context, of operators, or everything we started out with. Does this make sense? Does this make sense physically, what we get here? And instead of 1, we can also say, well, the probability is greater or equal to some number r, which is between 0 and 1, or we can just look at this internal probability. And the question is this sensible physically? And yeah, as I investigated in number 4 there, it seems to me that this model, when we go back from this internal picture again, externally, it seems to make sense physically. For example, this is an internal real number. So for each context C, this gives me a real number in sets. And if I consider the supremum of all these contexts of these real numbers, then I just get this guy back. The probability of finding the probability that if we measure A, we find a value in delta. So we can get, standard quantum probabilistic statements. We can retrieve that from this internal picture. We can do more than that, but yeah, that's basically described in number 4. Number 5 over there, that's a preprint I'm, very close to finishing. And that goes back to the contravariant to this pre-sieve model and asks, can we, in this setting, can we also use this internal language, this spectral pre-sieve? Is this an internal topological space or locale in a precise mathematical sense? These spaces of values that you consider, are these spaces in a precise sense? Our physical quantities, are these continuous maps? Icon and states are these valuations, and can we get everything that they derive externally from this internal picture? I say the answer is to a very large extent, yes. And I would like to close off with the remark of why I consider it important. Because this, yeah, I think it's important to have a strong interplay, to create a strong interplay between the mathematics of topos theory on the one hand and the physical motivation mostly given in the work of Butterfield and Isham on the other. Because at the moment, the few people working on this, well, for most of the time, it's about taking stuff which we know from normal quantum theory and to reformulate it in a nice way in one or possibly both of these topos models. But of course, at some point, we want to stop rewriting stuff which we already know from quantum theory and gain new insights and foundations. Whether this is possible with these topos models, I'm not sure yet. I think after playing with these for some time, I'd say it does show some promise. I mean, it's flexible, it's workable, and yeah, I think it's a nice formalism, but I've no clue if we really can get new insights and foundations from there. But I do consider it a, well, I'm not sure if it's a necessary condition, but at the very least, it would be extremely helpful to have a strong interplay between the mathematics and the physics here in order to get some insights. And I think I will leave it at that. From the internal perspective, when I consider the internal perspective, this the constructions, the, or at least the translations, look like that of classical physics. So what I'm hoping for is that when I consider the topos model from an internal perspective, then I can, well, consider it in a somewhat realist way. It will not be completely like classical physics because, well, one thing, it can't be, of course, but also topos mathematics is just somewhat different from classical mathematics. So also already in the mathematics, there are some differences, but I like to think of the internal perspective in a somewhat realist way. Anyway, when I move external, spell out everything in terms of these contexts and operators, I tend to think of what I get there in terms, in instrumentalist terms. So that's
is the external description appropriate to an observer who's external to the system? Is it as simple as that? No.
This is also far from settled. External, I don't. I mean, you're really using internal and external in the sense of topos theory here, not in the sense of an observer. Yeah, I think I can't go further than that. Sorry. Yep.
So from the internal point of view, what is the space of truth value? Is that a meaningful question?
Well, we can talk about truth values internally and externally. And internally, what is the space of truth? Mathematically, these are equivalent. There's just two different ways of thinking about exactly the same. But I think truth values are most easily described externally. And for a pre-sheaf model, a truth value corresponds to a collection called a sieve on the context process. So it's a set of context such that if C is in there and D is a smaller context, then D should also be in there. Yeah, yeah, any objects.
Can we ask how many elements it has? Is that meaningful? I mean, I'm just wondering if in some sense it's just true and false, again.
No. Also internally, when I look at ask how many elements does it have, so I'm just, when I look at it internally, I'm guessing that I'm looking at the number of, at each context C, I'm looking at the number of sifs on C, or covariantly I'm looking at the number of co-sifs. It will not be just true and false. You will, no, it will have many between them.
Classically, there's a condition called screening off, or sometimes it's called what if cells were causal locality, local causality. I forget which one, local causality. Local causality. Which, if you assume it, then you derive the Bell equation. So, therefore, I can't hold in quantum mechanics, and therefore, quantum mechanics isn't causally local in some. It's always an interesting question, is quantum mechanics causally local in some quantum sense of the word? So it seems to me you have an opportunity here to say yes. Right? In other words, I'm not sure whether the formalism will let you ask that question, but you have a lot of the ingredients. You have probability, you have states, and so on. So if you assume hidden variables, what?
Does it have compound systems?
Compound systems?
Yeah, you can look at composite. That will be no problem. Okay, well.
So then you can ask whether, I'm not sure exactly what it is, but if there's enough structure here, you might be able to translate the statement of local causality into this topos language.
I will definitely look into that. Okay. Well, sounds at least clear enough that I can look for the question and try to ask it both internally and externally and see okay. Well, thanks very much for the suggestion. I will look into that. There's still some subtleties here which need to be resolved. One thing in the Cope pre-sheaf, what I would like is that when I start out, for example, with something commutative in both approaches, so something which feels classical enough, the whole structure, the whole operator algebra is commutative, then I just want my deformalism only to look at this maximal context, that there is no, that it acts like sets, like you were working in sets, that only the top context, that one matters. And in both approaches, that's not completely the case. So I think that in both approaches, it does not treat classical physics classically enough. So there are some subtleties there that which need to be resolved before applying this to a classical system. And so mathematically, I'm just thinking of something commutative. It just looks like we're working in sets, at least under some clear translation. But that's an excellent point, yeah.